the first one of three lectures on Luther. I've entitled the first one, lecture number one, Luther's Development. And the second lecture tomorrow would be Luther's Breakthrough. Here I've translated simply, literally, the word which the Lutheran, the German Luther scholars usually employ. Luther's Durchbruch, his breakthrough, and then our third lecture on Wednesday will be Luther's Reformation. Now, having said this, I'm going to have to turn right around and revise what I've said. So rather than call these lecture one, lecture two, lecture three, it might be safer to call them part one, part two, part three, because I'm certain in advance, as I've looked over my notes for today's lecture, that I won't be able to include in today's lecture all five of the points which appear on the projection screen. If we're lucky, we'll get through the first four of those parts and take up the fifth part tomorrow, and after that begin part two on Luther's Breakthrough. Before I do that, just two things, two housekeeping details. One is that in view of the fact that this coming Thursday is registration day for first year men, isn't that right? And there'll be no class, which would mean that the discussion groups for this course, H140, which would ordinarily meet on Thursday, cannot meet. And this raises the question, then, what about the discussion groups which would ordinarily meet on Friday? What Mr. Otting and I have agreed to is this. As far as an enforced attendance goes, let's skip it this week, but Friday at 1:30, Mr. Otting and I will both be in the usual classroom, and for any of you who would voluntarily like to come to discuss the reading, we'll be there. So Friday at 1:30, if you happen to be in the usual Thursday groups or in the usual Friday groups, you're most welcome to come. But this is simply a matter of your own choice. The second thing, it's a little more closely related to the lecture today, has to do with simply fattening out your bibliography on Luther. You have numerous titles listed in your mimeograph bibliography for this course. And then you might notice, if you look at the Dillenberger paperback selections of Luther, that also has a selected bibliography, and a rather good one. To those two bibliographies, may I simply add four titles, and I add these only because they're very recent additions. It so happens that all four of them are also very good ones. One of them was originally written in English, three were not, and they are translations into English. The first one is Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, Lau, L-A-U, and it's simply entitled Luther, translated by Robert Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R, Philadelphia, Westminster Press, 1963. The next one is by B, B as in boy, A as in, B as in Brian, that's his, Brian A. Gerrish, G-E-R-R-I-S-H, B-R-I-A-N, Brian Gerrish. Grace and Reason, A Study in the Theology of Luther. And that is published by the Oxford University Press at Oxford, 1962. Grace and Reason, A Study in the Theology of Luther, Oxford University Press, 1962. Mr. Garish is a church historian at McCormick Seminary, north side of Chicago. I think a native Englishman. And then a third one, recently translated by Lennart, that's L-E-N-N-A-R-T, Pinoma, P-I-N-O-M-A-A, P-I-N-O-M-A-A, Lennart Pinoma, he's a Finn, and his book is entitled Faith Victorious, An Introduction to Luther's Theology. And that book is translated by a man from the same seminary, by the way, from which the other translator, Robert Fisher, comes, the Lutheran Seminary in Maywood. Walter Kukkonen, K-U-K-K-O-N-E-N, translated by Walter Kukkonen, another Finn. That's published by Philadelphia Fortress Press. And then a fourth title. Here's an old classic, which has been somewhat recently revised by the German author, and then the revised edition has recently been translated into English. In fact, I don't believe it's even hit the streets yet. The publication date announced was January the 2nd. This is by Gerhard, G-E-R-H-A-R-D, Ritter, R-I-T-T-E-R, Luther, His Life and Work. That has been translated from the German by John Riches, R-I-C-H-E-S, New York, Harper and Row, 1964. All the books are small, and they're all about the same size, and all sell for about the same amount, I suppose, all under $5, I believe. Give or take a few pennies. All right. Well, Luther's development. The problem I face, and I sympathize all the more now that I stand up here and see what Mr. Otting has to go through, the real problem is not what to include, but what to exclude in the short time that's available to us. Start with the obvious, I suppose, in Martin Luther's case. He was born on November 10th, 1483. At least we're reasonably sure of that date. Seems to have been some uncertainty, even in the mind of his own family, and Luther scholars have sometimes debated whether it should be 1483 or 1482 or 1484. Certainly doesn't change the nature of the Lutheran Reformation. His father was Hans Luther. His mother's name was Margareta Lindemann, by the way, was her last name, in case there should be any Lindemanns in the crowd. For a long time it was thought that her maiden name was Ziegler, in case there are any Zieglers in the crowd. It wasn't Ziegler, it was Lindemann. And they grew up in a little town called Mohra, M-O-H-R-A, with an umlaut over the O. Mohra is close to Eisenach. And Hans, since he was not the eldest son of his father, was therefore also not entitled to the inheritance of his peasant father by German tradition. And so the only thing for him to do was to move. And in that particular area, the logical alternative was to go into mining. Now, for a short time, he and Margareta, his wife, moved to Eisleben, and it was there that young Martin was born. But that was only really a temporary stopover for Hans and Margareta. And when Martin was about a half year old, they moved to Mansfeld, M-A-N-S-F-E-L-D, and that's where they stayed. By the way, if any of you are habitués of Town Hall, you should make it a point to get to know the owner of Town Hall, a little elderly, ruddy-faced German man by the name of Herr Schwartz. You'll find him very good company and a marvelous conversationalist. And one of the interesting things about Herr Schwartz is that he himself hails from this whole area of Mera, Eisleben, Eisenach, and can speak very warmly about that locale. It's almost like having been there to hear him describe the country. Come to think of it, tomorrow is Tuesday. I think Tuesday, isn't this right, when Tuesday when Town Hall has its weekly businessmen's luncheon. This is when Herr Schwartz, who's quite a chef, prepares a special kind of meat pie. That's the day to go. I don't know whether it's a clergy discount or not, but should ask him about Eisleben and Eisenach and Mera. All right, so Hans and Margareta moved to Mansfeld, and here it was that they settled, and here it was that young Martin grew up, went to school, a little boy. At the age of 14, about the time that you folks went to high school, he was sent to a Latin school in Magdeburg, M-A-G-D-E-B-U-R-G. And very shortly after that, for reasons which are not at all clear, he was transferred to St. George's School in Eisenach. And that's where he finished out his, what we might call his secondary education. And then in 1501, he was enrolled at the University of Erfurt. About 18 or 19 years old at the time. So his ages correspond roughly to the ages of people in our own generation when they go to grade school, complete grade school, go to secondary school, complete secondary school, and go to college. We might stop and ask a few questions, though, before we proceed. Questions about Luther's own home background. And I pause over these questions only because in interpretations of the Reformation, Luther's own background has often tempted a great many historians to find the clues to the secret of the Reformation in all sorts of things in his own past. Now, of course, we don't nearly have time to explore any one of these alleys in detail this afternoon. Let's just say a word about each one of the major questions that has arisen in connection with Luther's past and the connection that his past may have had with his later reformatory work. There is a question, for example, from which class of society did Luther really come? Hoping thereby that we might find a clue in his own social situation to his later attitude toward the church, or a clue toward his later attitude toward society, for example, the peasants. Well, the point has been made that Luther was really a farm boy. On the other hand, however, there's very little to be made for this point. He never lived on a farm. His father, at least by the time young Martin came along, was no longer a farmer. And even the kind of ancestral farm family from which Martin's father came was not the kind of peasant class which later in southern and southwestern Germany rose up in the so-called peasants' revolt. Martin's grandfather was the kind of semi-independent tenant farmer called an Erbzinser, E-R-B-Z-I-N-S-E-R, a hereditary tenant farmer who, to be sure, had to pay a kind of land tax. This was never thought to be oppressive. It was only thought to be fair and right, and was free to exercise a great deal of independence. So at least in his ancestral line, and through the experience of his father and grandfather, it can hardly be said that Luther had an appreciation at first hand with the situation of the peasants, at least not particularly the kinds of peasants against whom he decried later on at the time of the Peasants' Wars. Or sometimes the storytellers give you the impression that in Wittenberg, for example, when he preached in the town church and had in his congregation, of course, a good many farm folk, that he felt a special affinity to them because they were so much like what he had come from. Well, That's all right for storytelling. It's highly questionable, though, on historical grounds. For one thing, it would have meant that if he'd had a real down-to-earth sort of chit-chat familiarity with them, that he would have had to be able to speak Plattdeutsch with them, Low German, or even Sorbian. Do you folks know what Wendisch is? I know there's a man in the senior class, Don Philip, who comes from Giddings, Texas, and this is one of these so-called Wendisch pockets of German Lutherans down there. And the brand of German they speak is, it's not even recognizably German. It has much in common with some of the Slavic languages, I take it. Well, and so this was the sort of tongue that some of the German peasants spoke around in the area of Wittenberg. This strand, in other words, of Luther's ancestry, namely his affiliation with the rural Germany, can quickly be overdone. On the other hand, you'll find the sort of emphasis that says, no, that's right, he wasn't primarily from the farm culture of Germany. He came from the city culture of Germany. Well, here too, a qualification ought to be entered. You can't really think of Luther's upbringing as being the kind of upbringing that went on in those cities of Germany which were the great cultural centers of Germany that were arising at the time, like Nuremberg or Augsburg. Mansfeld just wasn't that kind of town. Nor did Luther's folks belong to this stratum of city life. Now, it must be said, on the other hand, that if they were commoners, and they were, they weren't poor folk. Hans, by this time, was an independent lessee. He had leased a mine, a smelting furnace, rather, and he was evidently held in high repute in the community of Mansfeld. He was a kind of ward healer. Perhaps that conjures up the wrong image for you. He was a representative to the town council of Mansfeld in behalf of his ward. The towns were often divided into Viertel, into quarters, and Hans Luther was a Viertelmeister. So he held a kind of political office at the same time. And among that class of people, evidently it was not at all uncommon for these people who were rising in the social class, who were coming into modest wealth, to have rather ambitious aspirations for their youngsters. And perhaps lots of us here in this room can appreciate that kind of mentality. It might represent the sort of home from which we have come. Then there's the question about the religious temper of the Luther home. Well, there seems to be nothing in Luther's family background which said that for reasons of tradition or family reasons he had to become a priest. There's no evidence that there were any clergy, any priests in the Luther ancestry. In fact, as we'll see in a moment, all the indications are to the contrary. Still, it's true that what evidence we have indicates that it was a very pious home, that Hans and Margareta were weekly, W-E-E-K-L-Y, were weekly attendants at Mass, and faithful in saying confession, combined with the usual measure of superstition that you would expect to find among the German miners. But as you know, perhaps, from other encounters, if anything, Hans Luther, Martin's father, was rather seriously opposed to his son's entering the priesthood. Now, whether or not this meant that the father had anything against the clergy is an altogether different question. All that we can say for sure is that his father was disappointed when his son entered the monastery and the priesthood, because this meant a cutting short, a complete frustrating of the ambitions which the father had for the son to enter into the profession of the law as a lawyer. Well, how about his early schooling? Are there any clues here which might shed some light in which, let's say, by the advantage of hindsight, would enable us to see the early glimpses into what he later turns out to be as the reformer? I think not. Very ordinary schooling. And here, too, the storytellers can mislead us, even though what they say about the young boy Luther is very satisfying and interesting. You get the impression sometimes that because he and the other boys were at school were choir boys, and they went down the street singing and begging for goodies, and it was usually money, not food. kind of pious form of trick or treat, I guess. That therefore he must have been particularly poverty stricken, and this sort of puts him in the log cabin tradition of great men. But that isn't true either. As we've already had occasion to observe, he really wasn't poor in that sense. Or sometimes you may hear it said about his early schooling that the fact that he was exposed to some of the Latin classics already in Latin school and at Eisenach probably explains his interest in later German humanism. Well, that is stretching a point, too. For one thing, the Latin which Luther read, by the way, Mr. Otting earlier this quarter referred to Donatus, perhaps you remember, who he referred to him in connection with Jerome. And Donatus's Latin grammar was still the standard Latin grammar at the time of Luther, when Luther went to elementary and secondary school. And the sorts of classics which were read, Pseudo Cato, which I don't suppose you have read, but maybe you've read Aesop. You read Aesop. Terence. And the Latin in which he read them was medieval Latin. It was not the Latin of the humanists. It was not Latin constructed on the mode, let's say, of Cicero. It was the Latin of the medieval monks. And the Latin which Luther employed so freely as an adult later on. Most of his academic lectures are in Latin, and he spoke it almost as freely, perhaps at least as freely, as he spoke German. The Latin which he spoke was really the Latin of the medieval monk, and not so much the new, polished, sophisticated Latin of the German humanist. There is one epoch, I suppose, one strand in his schooling, which might be made to shed some light on his later reformatory work. And here there seems to be at least relative agreement among the Lutherforscher, the Luther researchers. This was in the brief stint that he did at Magdeburg before he shifted over to Eisenach. And the school at Magdeburg was conducted by the so-called Nullbrüder, literally the zero brothers. They were from the Brethren of the Common Life. It was a teaching order, I suppose, something like CBC over here on Clayton. And a teaching order that had a particularly warm feeling for the common folk. They were distinguished by a kind of heartfelt piety. And one of the phrases, which was almost a trademark of the Brethren of the Common Life, was also almost a trademark of later humanism, and that was the term simple Christianity. And the simpler, the better. This often meant a Christianity which was as unencumbered by theology as it could possibly be, as unencumbered by things liturgical as it could possibly be. But the simple Christianity of Jesus and the cross, and a very emphatic strand in this piety was the imitation of Christ piety. One of the standard manuals for the Brethren of the Common Life was Thomas A'Kempis's Imitatio Christi. And it's interesting to see the affinities between this sort of piety, which is represented in the Brethren of the Common Life on the one hand, and some of the later humanists on the other hand. It's interesting, for example, that the great humanist of the time, who for a while seems to be Luther's ally, later on turns out to be his arch opponent, Desiderius Erasmus, who also could speak very glowingly about this sort of heartfelt Jesus piety, about the Imitatio Christi, who used the phrase, this Simplicitas Christianismi, over and over again, that he too, Desiderius Erasmus, had been trained, and for a much longer period of time had been trained by the Brethren of the Common Life. Now this seems to have been the first sustained exposure to German mysticism that Martin had in his training. Although here again, it seems every time we put up a point we chop it down again, and here too, it's very easy to be carried away and to say this accounts for some of the important emphases in Luther's later Reformation work. Well, the fact is that one of the strong planks in his platform, in his later Reformation theology, was to turn against the Imitatio Christi piety. He allowed room for it, but it certainly was not soteriological. It was not to be conceived of as a way of salvation. All right, the university, monastery, and priesthood. It was 1501, we said, when Luther matriculated at the University of Erfurt. And it seems that there was never any question but that that's where he had to go, and he had to enroll in the curriculum in which he enrolled, because his father was determined that at least his eldest child, and Martin was the number one son, should have the advantage of the sort of education which Hans Luther himself did not have. And he had great plans for his son. He should study law. As you know, at this time, this meant studying two kinds of law. And the opportunities for a man trained in the law were very promising. He might get a job, for example, with one of the burgeoning city councils, or a job in a princely court. And coming from the towns, as Martin did, he would be eligible for this kind of university education. And so it was in 15:1.
And the opportunities for a man changing the law are very promising. You might get a job, say, into one of the Virginian city councils, or a job in a princely court. And coming from the town as Martin did, he would be eligible for this kind of university education. So it was in 15:1 that he went to the University of Air Force. All the university was already a long established and respectable tradition. I didn't begin to study law, however, right away. Yes. No, 1501. 1501. Oh, no, 1521 would have meant that you'd have to go back to school after the 1595 teaching. Some people thought you ought to that after that. 1501. Out of his first 4 years, the first 2 years, were not in law. You can't really think of Martin as a law student. He was enrolled in the Faculty of the Arts at Oak Airport. And this meant that he was exposed to the usual medieval curriculum, the trivium, T-R-I-V-I-U-M, grammar, dialectics, rhetoric, roughly equivalent to, let's say, what we would call the grammar, logic, and what do we call it now? In high school and college, communication, persuasive communication, writing and speaking persuasively. And then, in addition to the trivium, there was, perhaps you remember, the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Evidence is that the indicator that he was a very good student. Evidence seems to be also that he was capable of having a good time. One, I suppose, is not exclusive of the other, necessarily. And here a question arises again about the influence of this chapter in his life upon his later reformatory work. It would be hard to pretend that in the kind of liberal arts education, if you may call it that, which he got at Airport, that here you find Luther blossoming forth as the young humanist. The humanistic reformation of the universities in Germany didn't really come about until many years later, when Philip Melanchthon himself undertook the reformation of the German universities from Wittenberg outward. So this wasn't really the new look sort of school at Erfurt that the German universities were to become later on. But this still raises another question. It could have been that the philosophical temper in the arts faculty at Erfurt might have laid the groundwork for the general theological outlook which Luther represented in his later Reformation activities. And here there is at least a possibility that this is so. At the University of Erfurt, so many of the courses at the undergraduate level were taught by what we would call graduate students. It would be as though, let's say, the junior college and the senior college which you attended would be on the same campus with Concordia Seminary, and that some of the, let's say, the fourth year men or the graduate students here in seminary would help teach courses in grammar to the freshmen and sophomores in college on the same campus. And this is considered to be a privilege that they had this opportunity to teach. Undoubtedly, a good many of Luther's teachers, when he was enrolled as an undergraduate at the University of Erfurt, were graduate students. And the predominant number of these graduate students who taught in the undergraduate years were graduate students in the Faculty of Theology. Now, I know that you can carry your conjecture too far too fast on this point, but it wouldn't be awfully improbable, would it, that at least some of the courses, like the more philosophical courses, where there was an opportunity for the teacher to wield some kind of theological influence in the teaching of his subject. But here, some of the predominant theological temper which prevailed at Erfurt at the time might come through to the undergraduate students. Well, what was the predominant theological temper in the faculty of theology at the University of Erfurt at that time? About this, we can be pretty sure. To give it a name, and Mr. Otting has introduced you to this term earlier, Erfurt was pretty strongly nominalist in its theology and in its philosophy. As a matter of fact, two of the really leading spokesmen of late medieval nominalism were in the theological faculty at Erfurt at the time. One of them is Bartholomaeus Arnoldi, like Arnold with an I added. Bartholomaeus Arnoldi von Usingen, he's often referred to simply as Usingen. If you came from Hoboken, people would simply refer to you as Hoboken. Sometimes we do that with the high Texas. So Usingen was one of the great nominalistic lights in the Faculty of Theology at Erfurt at the time, and perhaps the even more prominent one was Truttbetter, T-R-U-T-T-B-E-T-T-E-R. First name was Jodocus, J-O-D-O-C-U-S, Jodocus Truttbetter. Now, whether Luther actually studied under these men, we cannot be sure. Not at all unlikely that he sat in, at least on lectures of theirs. He must have been part of the general atmosphere which they influenced. And now comes a really decisive event. He finishes his program in the Faculty of the Arts, Erfurt. Gets his master's degree. That isn't the decisive event I'm talking about. It's his entering the monastery on July 17th, 1505. And here is an event in Luther's life which has provided a veritable hunting season, in and out of season, for Luther researchers to speculate as to the reason why he entered the monastery. The external explanations are pretty clear, but these don't even begin to get close to whatever theological explanations there might have been, assuming that there was a theological explanation for his entering the monastery. And one would expect there'd be some kind of theological explanation for that. 15 days before, this is the external data about which we're very certain, 15 days previous to this, it should have been on July the 2nd, 1505, Luther was walking back to school, you can picture this, from home. He had been at Montfeldt, and he was walking back to Erfurt. And perhaps you know the story, perhaps you've seen it in CinemaScope almost. There was this dreadful thunderstorm, and lightning struck very close to him, and it was on this occasion when he vowed. And he took an oath that he would enter the monastery. Beyond that, however, what was the surrounding, what were the environing factors which accounted for his making this kind of decision in the face of this sort of pyrotechnic circumstance? And here, too, as I said, there are all sorts of speculations. One of the more bizarre explanations by a Roman Catholic historian
Reinhold Beyendorf, B-E-I-J-E-N-D-O-R-G. And otherwise, by the way, rather creditable historian, but also gifted with great imagination. Beyendorf proposed that Luther had evidently owed his father a debt involving the cost of his education, and had been home, and had evidently had a falling out with his father, and now, either to escape the range of his father's influence, or to escape his liability for the debt, he went back and entered the monastery. There's not the slimmest leg to stand on for this explanation. Many, many years later, when Luther was lecturing on Genesis, he's talking about how Jacob leaves Laban and makes an offhand kind of personal reference here, from which Weinbach makes this elaborate deduction that, like the parting of Jacob and Laban, so Martin and Hunt had parted when, years before, in 1505, Martin had come from Mount Delta Airport and entered the monastery. Well, that one isn't even taken seriously by the other historians. There may be the question, though, whether one of the reasons Luther entered the monastery wasn't that he just had decided that the law was not the profession for him. This is certain enough. He says, for example, in his later Tishrei, in his table talk, that he just wouldn't have made a Jewish. And there's no reason to begrudge him that self-diagnosis. It's very likely he might have made a very poor one. If he would have made a poor jurist, though, and I just add this, I don't think he would have been a poor jurist in that he lacked the gift for rational precision in his thinking. He was one of the sharpest disputants later on at the faculty at the University of Wittenberg. It was a kind of holy terror for graduate students who had to appear for their doctoral or their master's disputation to have Luther as the master from the faculty in charge of the disputation. Now, you don't have to go that far, though, to see how handily he handled the God-given gift of reason. His theology is full of this, and I suppose if I have any reason at all for stressing this point, it is that that feature in his theology is often overlooked. And it's often overlooked, you suspect, because people who are fond of Luther would prefer to think of him as not being very intellectual. They would prefer to think of him as being a kind of lovable but reckless bull in a china shop, sort of romantic, who sort of flailed out in all directions and didn't care quite how it came out as long as what came out was the gospel. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. What is required, I suppose, to get beyond this image is to simply examine the text of his lectures, for example, even of his sermons, for that matter, to find that this is not the case. Well, more on that later, but I obtrude the point at this juncture simply to say that if he thought that he wouldn't have made a good lawyer, he had his own reasons for thinking so, but I don't imagine that this is one of the limitations from which he suffered. Namely, that he didn't have the capacity for thinking things through clearly. A more telling question about his entering the monastery has to do with Luther's psychological state of affairs. And this is a desperately ticklish, delicate, and difficult question. There seems to be no doubt that perhaps even at this time, though we can't be sure, there's no reason to doubt it, though, that even at this time, Luther was plagued by, later on, he came to refer to as his great Anfechtungen, his Tentationes. In psychological terms, immense periods of melancholy, depression. Whether he experienced these at this early stage in his career,
or no, and if he did, whether he interpreted them in the religious way in which he did later on, we don't know. But it's not at all improbable that the high sense of what all God demands of a sinner and of how very far short the sinner falls from meeting God's demands, and the eagerness to improve and to perfect oneself, coram Deo, in the sight of God, might well have had a great deal to do with Luther's entry into the monastery. And since we say that, let's say something else. Another strand which the Luther researchers have seized upon to explain his entry into the monastery is the thing we've appealed to a little a few minutes ago, and that's the contact which Luther has had to date now with the theology of the nominalists. If he had imbibed what theology he knew by this point from the nominalists like Usingen and Jodocus, Pitbetter, and so on, and if this was the picture of the Christian faith with which he was conducting his life, then it isn't altogether improbable that that very picture of the Christian life might have at least encouraged the tack he took when he entered the monastery. The picture of God, let's say just a few words about this theology. I don't want to repeat what Mr. Otting has already told you, but just briefly, the picture de Deo, which you get in the high nominalism of, say, William of Ockham, Gabriel Biel, Jodocus Pitbetter, isn't the traditional picture of God which you got with Thomas Aquinas. He is not merely the invisible, supreme nature, graciously responsible for all creation, but the most significant thing about this deity in the theology of the Ockhamists, the nominalists, is that he is the free and majestic sovereign will. There is nothing that he cannot do. And the great theme of nominalist theology, especially when it speaks de Deo, is the theme of the sovereignty of God. Even the theory of knowledge that you find in nominalist theologians and philosophers bears out the same theme. There is no rational approach, no natural theology, which provides you any significant knowledge of this God. The way to come to a knowledge of him is only for him to freely and on his own initiative to disclose himself to man. And with this theology goes also a very high doctrine of predestination. This God, who is the sovereign and supreme and majestic and free will, saves those whom he has graciously predestined by analogy. Introduced the term, which becomes a fundamental term at the time of the Reformation, by his acceptatio, his acceptation of them. Last week, you read an excerpt in Dillenberger from Luther's lectures on Galatians of 1531, and perhaps you remember that there was one section in there on Luther's whole exegesis of Galatians 3:6. And Abraham believed, and God reckoned it to him for righteousness. This is the occasion for Luther's discussion of the whole notion of imputation, imputare, or reputare. And as he does this exegesis of Galatians 3:6, he squarely opposes what he takes to be the New Testament view of imputation against the nominalist notion of acceptation. Well, this is the nature of this God. Now,